Good evening and welcome to this evening's edition of Lehigh Valley Arts Salon. I'm Bill Altamont-Smith and our guests this evening are Deb Zacharakis and Andy Cassano, co-directors of the Zollner Arts Centre at Lehigh University. And we've invited them in to come in and tell us about the first half of their 2017-2018 season at the Zollner Arts Centre. Welcome, Deb and Andy. Welcome back.
Hi, Bill. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Okay, you're very welcome. Thank you. Glad you could make it to come down live tonight, and we have lots to talk about in your upcoming season. But firstly, Deb and Andy, just tell us really, really briefly a little bit about yourselves and your role at Zollner.
I'm Deborah Zacharakis, the Artistic Director at Zollner Arts Center. I curate the guest artist series. We do pre-show events. I select pre-show performers. I also work with the Visiting Lectures Committee, so we work with literary artists also.
Okay, so you do have a good scope, and yeah, that leads on to my next question, but let's Andy introduce himself.
Oh, hi, I'm Andy Cassano. I'm the Administrative Director for the Arts Center, and as the Administrative Director, I get to oversee all of the operations that happen for the 280-some events that come into the Arts Center, all the production, the marketing, the fundraising, the all the stuff that goes into actually making all of the wonderful art happens falls to me, and I love doing it every day.
Okay, and I think it shows when people visit Zollner. Deb, you just began to talk a bit about the scope, but just, you know, it's not just music that some people might think. So tell us the overall scope of what you cover.
So the guest artist series at Zollner Arts Center has multiple disciplines represented. We have dance, theater, circus. And as I mentioned earlier, we also have literary artists. And I spend my free time looking for great performances and trying to bring them to the Lehigh Valley to share with our audiences.
And you have a fine track record of doing that.
Thank you and, so much.
Hey, thank you, because that leads me on to the next question beautifully here. But in particular, you've got a great record selecting young jazz artists who are in the early stages of rising to much wider recognition. And I'm thinking particularly here of French vocalist Cyrielle Aimé, who you brought back for a second time last year when she had become much better known than she was the previous year when you had first had her on. And now this year, you're doing the same with the young Canadian trumpeter and vocalist, Bria Skomberg, who we will talk about later, her performance. But is this an area that you really focus on? And any insight you'd like to share with us on your artist scouting process?
So I'm looking all the time, whether I'm in the Lehigh Valley or in New York or in Montreal or in Barcelona. I'm interested in art, and that drives me to performances. Whether I see somebody on the street, on the subway, at Met Stadium, you know, my antenna is up to try to bring really accomplished and very good artists to the series at Lehigh and to the Lehigh Valley. So whether they are seasoned performers, whether they're widely known, or whether they're not widely known, I'm interested in presenting them on the series, and I have to commend the audiences at Zollner and all throughout the Lehigh Valley. They're curious, and they support good art no matter where it happens or actually when it happens.
Okay, and you're really doing a service to the art, bringing in lesser-known performers who you've talent-scouted and seen that they've got both the talent and the charisma to perform on a big stage like your stage. Not everyone is up to it. So being able to see whether they would fit on your stage is also another important thing, right?
Right. So, you know, they have to have enough repertory to perform for an hour. And we have, as I mentioned, we have a very discerning audience in the Lehigh Valley. People know what's good. People know what they like. And I think you have to be up to snuff, you know, to pass the critique in for Lehigh Valley audiences.
Okay, let's get on to talking about some of the artists you do have on in the first half of this season. And one that will be very familiar to listeners to do WDIY, in particular, Blend, and our other AAA programming is St. Paul and the Broken Bones. It's a retro R&B horn-driven R&B and soul band out of
Birmingham, Alabama.
Yes, yeah, not
it's
Birmingham.
White soul. This is in the USA. So the St. Paul and the Broken Bones, the Paul Janeway is the lead vocalist and anchors that great Southern soul sound. He's been compared to a lot of great soul singers, and Sly Stone, and there's a little bit of David Bowie, a little bit of Prince. He is an 8-piece band, and this is a group that, after his first album, their next album, they broadened the band base, so he'll be performing with Jesse Phillips and the other folks that have been on the subsequent albums that he put out. And they're a relatively new group, but it has a very new, very young group with a very old and wizened sound, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. That sort of analog, retro R&B sound that a number of younger artists are exploiting really well and that we love. There's a thickness and there's an organic quality to it. There's none of that harsh digital processing to it. And by the way, I believe you mentioned a number of the influences and people he's been compared to, but I understand he got some really complimentary comments from Keith Richard of the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
About he compared him to Otis Redding.
Otis Redding.
That's pretty amazing.
That's quite a compliment.
Right. Especially, he's a wide vocalist as well, right?
Right.
Yeah, so to get compared to Otis Redding. But yeah, Keith Richard, pretty good. Yeah, we've been playing this band. We got to know them here in DIY back in early 2014, and we played that album a lot. I will play a snippet of it when we go into the break.
Sounds good.
What date are they on, Deb?
St. Paul and the Broken Bones will be at Zollner Arts Center on Saturday, September 16th. It's an 8 p.m. curtain, and actually, there's a group called Rat Boys opening for St. Paul. No rats in the group and not all boys.
Interesting. But Deb, I'm looking at the program. Is the date moved? Because the program says Friday, September 15th.
That's the correct date. The Friday, September the 15th is the right date.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Hey, changes happen since programs happen, so didn't want to get people having the wrong date here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, okay. Friday, September the 15th, St. Paul and the Broken Bones. Let's move on to the jazz trumpet player. We talked to jazz trumpet player and vocalist Bria Skomberg. She's got a second disc out now, which has been getting some really wide acclaim. We talked about how you had her here last year and you're bringing her back this year. Now she has got a lot more popularity. Tell us a bit more about her and what turned you on to her.
So Bria is interesting. She's a great jazz trumpeter and a singer. So she's a very, very talented. She's very talented on both scores. She started out playing traditional jazz, and she's branching out now. She actually is composing. That traditional bent is just before she comes to us, she'll be in New York playing with at Birdland with the Louis Armstrong Armstrong Eternity Band. But she's coming to us with a quartet, and I think you can expect some traditional music, and you can also expect some of her own compositions.
Let's take a listen to a little bit of her. Not that one. Let's try the right one. This is Bria Skomberg. Well, we just caught a little bit of Bria Skomberg's vocals and her trumpet playing. And Deb, you were saying she'll be here with a quartet?
Yeah, and this young lady, interestingly enough, hails from the western side of Canada. She was born in Chilliwack, British Columbia, and went to school in Vancouver, and has relocated to the East Coast. She's in New York now.
Okay. One of the best ways of actually seeing her is a different type of format that we do, rather than just bringing her into the big Baker Hall and putting people into the seats. We actually do a couple of shows on what we call our onstage cabaret format, and this is one of these shows that we actually put seating and tables for about 170 people on the stage of Baker Hall and set up a small stage. You get really close up to the artist. There's a 7 o'clock show and a 9 o'clock show. There's also a dinner option available at 6 o'clock, or just a come and grab a drink for the 7 o'clock or 9 o'clock show. But you get a really, really intimate experience with a performer, and this is one of those shows that we're doing that with.
And I think, you know, a couple of the songs that people coming out might hear, Que Sera, you know, from the traditional sets, and Malaguena.
Ah, okay, yes, I see they are both on the album here. Let's just take a listen, a little brief listen more. Bria Skomberg appearing, let me check the program here, appearing on Saturday, September 23rd. As Andy said, on the Onstage Cabaret. Let me see, you've got some more good stuff happening fairly soon after that. Let's move away from music for a moment, and I notice you have a very interesting dance company on, I believe an all-male dance company, Compagnie Hervé Kubi.
Yeah, Hervé Kubi, the dancers are largely from Algeria and Burkina Faso. This is a country that I knew very, very little about before learning that Hervé Kubi had some dancers from Burkina Faso in the company. The dance language is urban, hip-hop, and some influence from capoeira, the Brazilian dance form, but it's very physical.
Yep.
The repertory they dance to is largely Middle Eastern, but also Bach. So it's interesting seeing this dance language applied to classical European music in addition to traditional Middle Eastern music. It's a 12-member, all-male, very powerful dance company.
That sounds really interesting. And Burkina Faso is just south of Mali and I think just north of Ivory Coast and Ghana. So I assume there must be some probably Malian influence in there as well, I would guess, or that type of West African music.
Right. And I understand that there's a little political issue with the men actually dancing that is in relation to their cultural and religious backgrounds.
Yes, that's been part of the issues in Mali, of course, yeah. Yes, certainly. So I hope you have no problem of them being here. And
No, I think it's just going to be a night of really powerful and moving dance.
All right, one to look forward to. Let's go back to some music. You have the Paco de Lucia project, and Paco de Lucia passed away less than a year ago, I think, right? Somewhere in the last year, I believe.
I think it was just a little over a year, but that was a real shock at 66. Paco died of a heart attack. I think it was on a beach in Mexico. And he performed at Zollner two times. And really, this is a tribute to a great guitarist, a tribute to Paco and the wonderful concerts he shared with us. It's a tribute concert not only in terms of our presentation, but it's pieced together by Javier Limón, who actually assembled the band. And the band will contain people, is made up of people who have performed with Paco in the past. In fact, people who were at Zollner and played. Antonio Sanchez, I think, is Paco's cousin. He's on lead guitar. and there will be vocals. Elaine Perez is the bassist. Israel Suarez is on percussion. Antonio Serrano is on harmonica. And that magnificent flamenco dancer, Farruko. So it's flamenco guitar. It's a caveat. This is not traditional flamenco. It is Paco's kind of updated, more contemporary flamenco.
Something along the lines of the Paco de Lucia concert that you had on, a phenomenal performance about 8 years ago?
It is. The same.
Yeah, okay. Well, if you were there for that, I suspect you'll be very interested in this one. And that one is happening on
Sunday, yeah. October the 15th. I think I have this one right. It's 7 p.m.
We are in sync on that one. Okay, the last music one. No, a couple more we're going to talk about quickly before we have a brief break. Pink Martini from the West Coast. You're bringing them in.
What a great band.
I have never heard them live. I've played their music many times. One to look forward to, right?
Yeah, yeah. I've worked with this band actually a couple of times. This is one of the acts that may not have a lot of name recognition for the area, but they are certainly very, very well known worldwide and across the United States. And if there's sort of like one of the sleeper concerts of the year for us, this is one of those concerts that if you don't know the name, don't worry about it. Just come out to hear it. You will not be disappointed at all.
So the band's sound is a combination of classical, jazz, pop, and they're actually dedicated to collaborating with different artists. They have two great vocalists. I think we're safe in saying that China Forbes will be the vocalist at Zollner Art Center, but they are dedicated to collaboration and global inclusivity. So they will have different types of music, not only American, but world music on their set.
Okay, I think we're going to have to take a short break. There is another band on the program right at the end, December 1, Friday, December 1st, Ranky Tanky, which worth checking out. Look them up. They're a band from down the South Carolina and Georgia islands performing very African-flavored music. They've remained true to the African roots of a lot of the residents on that island and the sort of a soul, gospel, African feel to their music. Ranky Tanky. And they're on, I'm looking at the program, Friday, December 1, right?
Another cabaret, two sets at 7 and 9.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a brief break, but we're going to go into it listening to a little bit of St. Paul and the Broken Bones, and we'll be right back after a couple of messages.
DIY. We thank the Baum School of Art, 510 Linden Street, Allentown, enriching lives through arts education for the past 90 years. Classes in art, design, and fashion for children, teens, and adults. For more information, baumschool.org or 610-433-0032.
Kitchen Funk Orchestra, led by trumpeter Bill Warfield, taking us out of the break. And that's a perfect intro to the Music Department series happening at the Zonal Arts Centre. I'm Bill Lutchmore-Smith, your host for this edition of LV Art Salon. And I'm talking with Andy Cassano and Deb Sakarakis of the Zalma Arts Center. Andy, tell us a bit about the Music Department series and in particular, the Hell's Kitchen Funk Orchestra that we just heard.
Well, as they do every year, both the Music Department and the Department of Theater at Lehigh are putting on some really fantastic performances that range a gamut of a lot of different musical and theatrical disciplines. And, you know, even though Lehigh may not necessarily be known for majors in music and theater, of which there are a number of really fantastically dedicated and talented students, there are hundreds of students at Lehigh that, while they're choosing to follow their major in another category, they're following their passion in the visual and the performing arts. So as we came out of the break, we heard a little bit of some of the fantastic prose that are put together that help teach the students at Lehigh. That was Bill Warfield's Hell's Kitchen Funk Orchestra. And they're performing on Saturday, September the 9th. And they're going to probably be doing some of their new music from their album Weather Report, which is a bit of a tribute to the Weather Report from, you know, album that of older fusion and funk great bands that were back in the day. And these are really fantastic studio musicians out of New York that Bill ends up putting together and bringing to Lehigh, not only to perform, but also to help teach our students as well.
You have quite a few other Lehigh bands performing as well, right? And the LU Philharmonic are performing late on in the first half of the season, right?
Yeah, at the end of the calendar year in December, Eugene Abulescu is conducting the LU Philharmonic in a really dynamic concert of John Adams, Beethoven, and Rachmaninoff. They're going to be performing John Adams' Short Ride in a Fast Machine, which is one of my favorite pieces of Adams' music, the Beethoven Fourth Piano Concerto, and Rachmaninoff's iconic and romantic Symphony No. 2. Three gargantuan works for any university orchestra to be performing that I know they're going to be up to the challenge. And that's on December 8th and 9th at the end of the calendar year.
And you also, oh, by the way, did we get in the date for the Hell's Kitchen Orchestra?
Yeah, that's Saturday, September the 9th.
Okay, thanks. And then there also is the Department of Theater program and a couple of productions this year. Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. And also Stupid Expletive Bird, directed by Pam Pepper, happening. Any comments about those two?
They're really fantastic comedies. The Stupid Bird is actually a tongue-in-cheek version. Well, it's inspired as a tongue-in-cheek version of Anton Chekhov's The Seagull. It's just updated for the 21st century.
And Waiting for Godot, that's directed by Augustine Ripper, I think, right?
Yes.
Yep. And that's a fairly, well, I can't say a standard treatment of Waiting for Godot, but the classic Waiting for Godot.
Yes, it will be. You know, one of the most best-known Samuel Beckett plays. Again, another fantastic comedy that was actually just done in England and was on one of the HD film for the National Theatre of London, I believe. But we're going to be taking on here in a live production on September and October, the end of September and the beginning of October.
Okay, excellent. Finally, your literary notation series. I think you have one thing coming up in this first half of the year.
On September the 12th in Baker Hall, we're presenting Anand Girihardas, who wrote a book called The True American Murder and Mercy in Texas. It's a really interesting story. It's a true account about a murder attempt after 9/11. There was a mechanic who decided he was going to go on a killing spree and wipe out people who looked as though they were from the Middle East, and killed two men. And this story is about one of his victims who survived. And it's an interesting treatment about what inspired the man to go on this killing spree, and also the incredible compassion of this surviving victim and how he worked to get the man's sentence changed from the death penalty to life in prison. So that's Anandjir Haridas on September 12th, 7:30 p.m. in Baker Hall. All these speakers this year are for free.
Wow, that piece sounds like really, really relevant to today.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay, we are out of time. More information can be found, Andy or Deb?
On our website at www.zonerartcenter.org. You can see videos, you can read anything you want, get to know these really fantastic performers that are coming through the valley this year.
Okay, thank you so much, Deb and Andy, for coming down here and sharing your insights on the program you've put together for the first half of the year at the Zollner Arts Center at Lehigh University. Thank you again.
Next up on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, At the Movies, a review of a current film with Paul Willistein of the Press.
The Glass Castle is a difficult-to-watch film with many rewards. Among the rewards are Oscar nominee-worthy performances by Woody Harrelson as Rex Walls, Naomi Campbell as his wife Rosemary Walls, and Brie Larson as one of their four children, daughter Jeanette Walls. The film is based on the 2005 best-selling memoir, The Glass Castle, written by Jeanette Walls about her poverty-stricken upbringing in West Virginia with an alcoholic father and an eccentric mother. Jeanette Walls is a former contributor to the Brooklyn alternative newspaper, The Phoenix, wrote the Intelligencer column for New York Magazine, and was a gossip columnist for MSNBC.com. The Glass Castle spent 261 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. While the performances are commendable, The Glass Castle suffers from flashback-itis. That's when a film jumps back and forth between present day and the past, in the lives of its characters, and in its storyline. This is always a challenge where multiple characters are concerned, especially as with The Glass Castle, where there are several children. Director Destin Daniel Cretton, director of Short Term 12 and I Am Not a Hipster, co-wrote the screenplay for The Glass Castle with Andrew Lanham, who wrote the screenplay for The Shack. The director fails at job number one. He doesn't advance the story, illuminate the conflict, and only serves to confuse the moviegoer. The Glass Castle presents a portrait of a brutal father, the likes of which hasn't been seen on the theatrical screen since perhaps The Great Santini, that starred Robert Duvall as the father. The Great Santini was based on the semi-autobiographical book by Pat Conroy. Brie Larson, who received an Oscar for The Room, does her best to keep the story together, but there are too many distracting storyline threads for her to be front and center, and she's not prominent enough in the storyline. A voiceover narration would have helped. Woody Harrelson gives one of his best performances as the ruminative, phlegmatic, alcoholic, cigarette-smoking father who fantasizes about building a glass castle on the family's West Virginia property. Naomi Watts is almost unrecognizable as the mother in a seamless, believable performance. The Glass Castle is a harrowing look at a dysfunctional family that somehow manages to inspire the moviegoer. It's appropriately dedicated to, quote, all families who, despite their scars, somehow find a way to love, unquote. The Glass Castle is MPAA rated PG-13 for mature thematic content involving family dysfunction and for some language and smoking. Opening August 25 are Tulip Fever. Justin Chadwick directs Cara DeVigny, Alicia Vikander, and Emmaus High School graduate Dane DeHaan in the romance drama. An artist falls for a young married woman while he's commissioned to paint her portrait during the tulip mania of 17th century Amsterdam. All Saints. Steve Gomer directs Cara Bueno, John Corbett, Barry Corbin, and David Keith in the drama. The movie is based on the true story of salesman-turned-pastor Michael Spurlock, the tiny church he leads, and a group of refugees from Southeast Asia. I'm Paul Willistein of the Lehigh Valley Press at the movies for WDIY.
You have been listening to Lehigh Valley Art Salon on 88.1 WDIY. Up next, Take Charge of Your Life, taking this up until 7 p.m. And then Steve Aronson will be your host for Folk Classics on this Monday evening. Again, thanks for listening to Art Salon. Up next, take charge of your life.
Good evening, everyone. It's time to take charge of your life. Hello, this is marriage and family therapist Eleanor Barbaro, your host, inviting you to take charge of your life on WDIY. The theme of this program is that so many events in life happen to us over which we have no control. Our only control is our response to life's situations. It is often said that 90% of life's events happen to us and 10% is what we make happen. Tonight we talk about how losing weight through willpower alone is often ineffective because eating habits, according to my guest this evening, are programmed into our brain at the subconscious level. And my guest this evening believes that hypnosis can help tap into the subconscious mind for insights into the origins of emotional eating and that hypnosis can reprogram the response to food. My guest this evening is Erica Flint, who is the author of Reprogramming Your Weight, Stop Thinking About Food All the Time, Regain Control of Your Eating, and Lose Weight Once and For All. Erica Flint is an award-winning hypnotist, author, and founder of Cascade Hypnosis Center in Bellingham, Washington, and is a co-host of a podcast series called Hypnosis. It is a pleasure to welcome Erica Flint, who will help us to understand how hypnosis can help us to lose weight forever and take charge of our lives. Welcome, Erica Flint.
Ellie, thank you so much. It's fantastic to be here today and share this information with your listeners.
Well, you have written a fantastic book, and it is so helpful to see all the people who have been struggling. How did you discover hypnosis? Did you ever have a problem with weight yourself, Erica?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely did have a problem with weight, and that was, I think that was about 18 years ago in 2000. And then I resolved that, but then the weight came back. And about 7 years ago, I had kind of one of those personal crisis things that a lot of us go through. So I had some personal issues that I struggled with, including my weight. And I got to a place in my career, in my life, where I was really questioning what's happening? What am I doing? Is this really what I want for my life? And at that kind of really low point, which I think is important for me to understand because that's where a lot of my clients are coming to me at this very low point. I had to make a decision, and at that point, I decided I wanted to live. I wanted to have a different type of life, and that is really when I kind of opened up to others, like opening my eyes to other possibilities. At the time, I was a software engineer for a very well-respected company. Great job, family, cars, all of that stuff, but something was missing, that fulfilling part. And that is right where I found hypnosis. And once I found hypnosis, it really changed my life in such a profound and deep way. I basically just left my other job, started doing hypnosis full time, and I just had to. I had to share this information with everybody that I could.
Well, I'm so glad that you came to this decision because it speaks to all of us who have had weight problems. And when I say us, I have to include myself. I've had a weight problem ever since I was 2 years old. And that meant that I was born at 7 pounds, 7 ounces, and up till the time of 2 years old, I did not gain any weight, and my mother was called to critical awareness by family members who said, "Shirley, you're not feeding this child. What are you doing? She's starving." And then they discovered that I had tonsils, and they took them out and gave me ice cream as a reward, and that was the beginning of my weight problem. So I understand.
Yep.
I understand.
Very common story where we have food that we are basically conditioned to eat wrong in a lot of cases. But when we're little, we get trained to substitute food to help us to feel better. So in your story, it was tonsils or, hey, you know, you have this surgery and we're going to give you ice cream afterwards. For other people, it's a skinned knee and they get a cookie or, you know, something else happens in school, they get a good grade and they go out for ice cream, that type of a thing. And so what happens is we get conditioned to associate in our brain something that happens, like maybe a bad feeling, with food, or even something good that happens, celebration with food. And pretty soon, that just becomes our go-to. Anything that happens to us, something bad, food, something good, food.
You have some interesting stories in your book about people coping with food. And most people are able to lose weight for a short amount of time. In other words, we're all successful in going on a diet for a week or two, maybe a month. And when we go off, we go off and we can't really maintain the weight loss. That's the problem. So you have some very specific examples of people who were suffering with problems and they discover you and hypnosis. Could you tell us about a couple of them? For example, Amy.
So Amy, Amy was suffering from grief. And, you know, this is something, unfortunately, that each of us will have to go to where we lose a loved one in our life. And she would turn to food. And she had been turning to food her entire life. And food was really one of the only times in her day where she felt good. And so imagine if you're talking with somebody and you ask them, you know, what makes you feel good? You know, what do you do in your life that feels good? And their only answer is, well, I like to eat, or food makes me feel good, or something like that. This is an issue for a lot of my clients. The only time during the day when they feel good is when they eat, and that's what was going on with Amy. I asked her, you know, how long has this been going on in your life that you've been turning to food to feel better? She said 40 years. And so a 40-year experiment with food to help her feel better, but in the end, it never really worked because she was always left feeling worse later. And so she ended up really being able to make some change through hypnosis. She had some realizations, and then she was able to make a change so that she didn't feel so lonely all of the time and started doing some other things in her life so food wasn't her best friend anymore. You see, she had put food up on a pedestal, and I think a lot of people do that, where they think food is going to be the answer to everything. And in her case, it just ended up causing so many problems. So once we replaced that with other things in her life that were really more meaningful to her, then she wasn't. She didn't turn to food all the time, which I think is one of the biggest problems. If you can go walking or singing or dancing or play with friends or something like that, that will go a long way to helping you resolve any issues with food.
Well, I think that's very important, and she was fortunate that she found you. How many sessions did it take for her to become aware of this? People would like to know, you know, when you go into hypnosis, how long does it take? Is it like 6 sessions, 8 sessions?
It's a really good question. It's different for every person, but most people start to realize what's been going on in the very first session. The problem is, like in the very first session, they realize, oh my gosh, what have I been doing? And they have moments of insight. The hypnosis that I do is insight hypnosis. So people have these moments of insight, this light bulb comes on, and then they feel so much better. They realize that there has really been something that has been missing from their approach to losing weight. And so you talked about earlier diets and how people can do them for a little while, but then they stop working, and they stop working because they're just too hard to do on a daily basis for most people. The residual side effect of that is, what's wrong with me, and I'm not good enough. And so people start to really feel that there is something wrong with them, that they can't lose the weight. So that's a real negative feeling, right?
Yes.
And so in that very first session, people feel hopeful. They're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize this was happening, and I didn't realize that was going on. The very first session, they're feeling better. But on average, I see clients 5 sessions in general, because even after they have that realization, and believe me, there's probably, you know, a total of, there's a realization every single session that I do with clients, but that first one is super powerful because it really lifts so much resistance and really negative feelings for the client, so they feel hopeful. And then when they feel hopeful, it's easy for them to make the changes. And the changes that I have my clients make are not huge changes. They have to be integrated into their life so that it's something they can do for the rest of their life.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Take Charge of Your Life. This is your host, Eleanor Barbaro. And this evening, we're talking with a very special guest, Erica Flint, who has written a very special book that all of us who are struggling with weight, and you notice I put us, all of us who are struggling with weight really would enjoy reading and integrating into our lives and maybe even making contact with Erica Flint. The book is called Reprogram Your Weight, and it's about how hypnosis can help unlock the underlying emotions that are causing us to hold on to the weight. Erica, so tell us a little bit more, because all of us struggle. Most of us, as I said earlier, we can lose the weight, but then we get it right back on. But what you're saying is we have to come to the understanding about what the underlying feelings are that are preventing us from stabilizing our weight. Can you give us another example from one of your clients?
Sure. I'll give you a great example. So Lisa really had, and we talked about ice cream earlier, Lisa loved ice cream and cake, and she would, you know, she was just really enjoying that type of dessert. In hypnosis, what we realized is that she didn't really love the dessert nearly as much as the fact that it reminded her of having that ice cream with her grandfather. And so we were able to separate the feelings out of love she had for her grandfather with the ice cream itself. And what she realized, and this is such an important point, I call this guilty residue. When you eat something and it makes you feel good in the moment, that's usually all that we're paying attention to. We have guilty residue hours later when we realize, oh my gosh, I really wish I wouldn't have eaten that ice cream again. And that just contributes to us feeling like this bad feeling about ourselves. I'm not good enough. What's wrong with me? When am I going to be able to fix this problem? So for Amy, what happened was she was able to separate. The reason I love eating ice cream is more that I love my grandfather. And when I eat it, it reminds me of him rather than